Greetings, this is James Gillen with As You Wish Talk Radio. We've got another great show. I give people a little bit of a heads up. We're having amazing activity here. We're having the mountain over here, Mount Adams, light up, and we're getting just some incredible footage of just massive light ships flying in and out, triangle ships with other light ships flying between them, and just some undeniable footage of these ships powering up with, you know, as many as 30 witnesses sometimes on the ground watching these events, observing them, and actually getting their own footage. So you want to type in Carmichael, California, because a whole fleet of ships just flew over that area. And so it would be a good one. Just Google it. It's Carmichael, California, UFO. Google it, and you can see the latest. We put it out on the newsletter. And if you want to be aware of all the latest happenings, you know, concerning Comet Elenin, the UFOs, the ships, the latest ancient history, all of the things that we put out, be sure and sign up on the newsletter at the eceti.org website. It's eceti.org website. So without any further ado, I wanted to bring Brian on the show, and Brian Forrester's got some amazing revelations that we want to share with you. And Brian was born in Rochester, Minnesota, USA, and he grew up on the west coast of Canada. At the age of 11, he became fascinated with the native art of the, hope I'm saying this, looks like the Haida native people, and began carving totem poles and other related art forms, learning from native teachers. After completing an honors Bachelor of Science degree, Brian decided to take up carving and sculpture full-time at the age of 25. In 1995, he moved to Maui, Hawaii, one of my favorite places, and was hired as an assistant project manager for the building of the 62-foot double-hull sailing canoe. And it's the ancestor of the modern-day catamaran, and it's called the Mo'okiha Opi'ilani sacred lizard that pierces the heavens. This project lasted for 2 years. They're having learned how to make Hawaiian outrigger canoe paddles from master carver Keola, looks like Sequiera. He started an online outrigger paddle business, which flourished internationally. Peru became his next major area of interest, and the study of the Inca culture led to his writing a book, A Brief History of the Incas, which is available on his site, and is also actively engaged with the Shipibo people from the central Amazon of Peru, promoting the sale of their traditional arts and crafts. And if you want to check that out, you can go to ShipiboSpirit.com, and that's on the website. The link is there if you want to check that out. And he's got other projects which were reserved and published books, include one about ancient history of Hawaii, the mysterious stone monuments of Peru that predate the Inca, and the search for the lost continent of Mu. And this will require combining all that he has learned so far with the trips to New Zealand, Hawaii, Easter Island. And it looks like a pretty fascinating adventure he's been on. So you can check that out at looks like Kala'i Spirit. It's KalaiSpirit.com if you want to check out that information. But without any further ado, we want to bring Brian on the show. Brian, are you with us?
Yes, I am, sir.
Hey, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
You know, some of your investigation are things that I've had to do some armchair investigation on, unfortunately. I wish I could have gone to check it out myself. But one of the things I'm really fascinated with is the Inca skulls. We call them the cone heads. And obviously, you've done a lot of work in that area. Is there anything you'd like to share with us, or we can start there and just move on from that topic?
Okay. Well, actually, right now I'm in a little seaside town in Peru called Paracas. Mm-hmm. And that actually is one would call the epicenter of the elongated skulls, because the largest ones in the world come from this direct area. So I've just been made the assistant director of the Paracas History Museum, which has the largest collection of elongated skulls in the world in terms of being in a private collection.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there any way, I guess it's been refused in the past, I don't know what's happened with that, but have they ever done any DNA samples on those skulls?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I'm sure you're acquainted with Lloyd Pye of the Starchild skull.
Yeah.
I'm directly involved with Lloyd. I actually sent him 10 DNA samples a couple of months ago from 5 different skulls from Paracas. And his geneticist, which is who's located in Texas, is just finishing up building a new laboratory, and we're hoping to get results within a month. And the thing is that Lloyd's very excited about it. It was just on a whim that I contacted him, and he said, "What you've been able to get samples from elongated skulls?" I didn't think it was a big deal, but he does. So he has them now, and we're hoping for results within a month.
Well, you know, that's awesome, because I was always wondering about that. You know, my feeling is that these skulls are going to go right back to the Anunnaki, you know, the most ancient ancestors. And, you know, I call them the genetic tinkers that were here playing around before, and actually which are part of our ancient DNA as well.
Well, that's a good point. The thing is that what we found definitely is that there are two different styles or sources of the elongated skulls. Of course, some people will be quite acquainted with the ones which are in Egypt during the Amarna period, as in Akhenaten and Tutankhamun. They seem to be genetically elongated. Most of the ones found in the world have been bound artificially by people for religious purposes, but I'm finding samples of both, ones that seem to be naturally elongated and others which seem to have been bound artificially.
Huh. Yeah, it'll be quite interesting. We'll have to definitely get you back on the show when the results come back.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I've always had a feeling that, you know, the binding of the skulls were actually just to mimic, you know, the gods or the Anunnaki or whatever you want to call them. Everybody has a different name for them, but you know, the ones who came from heaven to earth. I think it'll be really interesting when we find, you know, that we do share, you know, genetically. One of the things I was curious about now, is there just the skull, or were there other parts of the skeleton found as well?
Well, they have been found. That's actually what I'm trying to track down right now, because the skulls are displayed in museums, not as much as they have been. There actually seems to be some kind of cover-up going on, because two of the major museums in Lima had quite major displays of the elongated skulls, and they've been removed within the recent past for some reason. So that's why I was really intrigued when I came to Paracas and found this little museum that had this originally just one on display, and when I asked the director if he knew of more, he said he had 17 more in his possession. And so I was able to some degree, influence him to put them all on display, and all of them are in the museum now. And we're actually in the process of hopefully acquiring one or two more of the extremely elongated ones. And so now that we have we'll have a sample of about 18 different ones, I'll be able to do photographic and video analysis to be able to try to distinguish those which have been bound as compared to those which seem to be natural.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating, because it seems like all of this is tying together, and I'm sure you're familiar with Michael Tellinger's work and some of Sitchin's work, and all of this seems to be, you know, telling the same story, you know, with you know, a little different flair here and there on it. But the same story seems to be told, that there were some very large beings here in our ancient past, and, you know, they call them the Anunnaki, and I think that's where we got the image of the bearded god from, you know, in our ancient religious histories. But it does seem that these most ancient of beings, you know, were here, you know, at least 450,000 years ago, even before that, and have built some of these megalithic stone temples and things of that nature.
Well, that's the intriguing thing. My interest in it first began when I was actually writing my first book, A Brief History of the Incas, because there's a small museum in the basement of one of the oldest structures in Cusco called the Coricancha, which, you know, is said to have been built by the Inca, but it's one of those buildings which, you know, has joinery so tightly fitting that you can't fit a human hair in. And so this museum had a small, or has a small collection of these elongated skulls. And since my research about the history of the Inca goes back to Tiwanaku, which is their source, I found photographs there of, again, and examples of elongated skulls, and now it's led me to the coast of Peru. And so, you know, my theory is that the Inca themselves are descended from the Tiwanacans, who were descended again from the people of Paracas. And since Paracas is right on the ocean, I'm sure that the original elongated skull people, you know, sailed or traveled here probably, you know, by water, or, you know, maybe through the air, but definitely by water to reach the South American coast. So we do have a pattern that's already developed or developing of these very highly evolved beings that came and taught conventional humanity how to, you know, basically do everything.
Mm-hmm. It does seem to all point back. But I know in some of the teachings that I've studied a lot of the ancient arts and Yigong and things like that. And you go and trace all these ancient teachings, and you know, you trace them through China or Tibet or things like that, and they seem to all go back to Egypt, and then Egypt's basically, the from what I understand, goes back to the stars. But you know, when we keep following our roots back, they seem to all go back to either Africa or some of these really ancient sites, you know, that were sites that were referred to as the, you know, the home of the gods or the Anunnaki.
Exactly. Well, one point related to that is the fact that the original name, you know, the famous megalithic site that people love to go to in South America, of course, is Machu Picchu. And that actually, I've learned, is not its true name. Machu Picchu is the name of the mountain on which the ruins are located. And because Hiram Bingham, who was the discoverer, named it that, from then on, it's always been called Machu Picchu. But the original Quechua, which is the Inca language name, is Iampu. And Iampu means the dwelling place of the gods.
Hmm. Yeah, it's definitely all coming together. I'm sure this turns turns over a lot of old programming, you know, old religious programming and things of that nature. And you know, it's very clear now that you know, our civilization didn't begin, you know, at 6,000 years ago, you know, with Adam and Eve, and maybe Adam and Eve were borrowed stories from a much, much more ancient experiment or experience that happened on the earth.
Well, of course. I mean, you know, immediately back from the Bible, you go again to Sitchin's work, and there, you know, the same name, Adam and Eve, with slight variations, are there. But we're also finding evidence in terms of the megaliths in South America, especially in Peru and in Bolivia, that they, you know, they could very well date back to at least 10,000 and possibly 20,000 years. Mm-hmm. And there are even oral traditions that say that humanity began in South America.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I've heard different traditions, and they go back. It depends on which group you talk about. But you know, my feeling is that there may have been several landing places, you know, of the ancient ancestors, and you know, one was maybe Iraq, and the other one was Peru, and one was, you know, all over the place. You can find remnants of that, and Africa definitely has some extremely ancient sites. I know Michael Tellinger writes a lot about that and talks a lot about that. And
that's true.
Yeah, and he talks about the you know, basically the landing place of Inki, I think it is, you know, they seem to have found, you know, his one of the most ancient sites. And I guess that dates back to something like 450,000 years ago, maybe even further.
Uh-huh. Well, that's actually, there's an interesting correlation with that, too, because, you know, Enki, or Enki, which supposedly comes from Sumerian, the god, the principal god of the Incas was Inti. So it's only, you know, one sound or one letter sound different to have the same possible creator.
Yeah, it's interesting. I found out too, you know, it's funny when you look through ancient history, a lot of people don't know this, but You know, Yeshua ben Joseph or Jesus, who they worship a lot of times, is Jesus actually means Jesus, which means son of Zeus. And so the Greeks gave him the name Jesus. And over in Israel, where he was hanging out, they called him Yeshua ben Joseph. And I guess he was known as, I think it's Isa and some other travels when they followed his history of where he traveled through Tibet and India. And, you know, there's a lot of research on that. And I think it was Isa. I think they called him Isa. I'm not sure the exact name, but you know, it does make sense that each group would actually end up changing the name a little bit or refer to them and tie them in with their ancient gods or something of that nature.
Well, that's a good point. And you find, you know, the studying of the original languages of places always gives you leads. This is a bit of a tangent, but Easter Island, of course, is very intriguing because there it is, you know, 2,000 miles off the coast of South America, and it has been shown to have at least two different time periods of occupation, the oldest one possibly being directly influenced by the megalithic builders from South America. And one word which has, you know, I've only begun to study it, but one word that has an amazing similarity is that they used to grow totora reeds, which are the reeds which you find in Lake Titicaca. They seem to be indigenous in Easter Island, which is amazing. And so they used to call the boats that they used to make out of these reeds a pora. And the same word you find on the coast of Peru for the exact same kind of boat is called a tora. So that mm-hmm. shows an oceanic connection between those two places.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how it's tied in. I'm wondering, did you ever have a chance to meet Nahi when you're over in Maui?
No.
Yeah, she's one of the kahunas over there. She's since passed on, but she was a really good friend of mine. And we did a lot of interesting work together. And one of the things, I was over on Kauai and was doing a workshop there. And this name came up in the workshop, and he was like this ancient of ancients that came in. And I can't remember the name. I'll have to remember it. But it wasn't a Hawaiian name. I think it had a B in it and another letter they never used. But we looked up this name to find out what it was about because it didn't make any sense. And it was during one of the classes I was doing. I do these self-mastery classes, and this being came in, really powerful being. So anyway, we got his name, and I look it up, and there's a whole province in Africa named after this guy under his name. And it was a name none of us have ever heard before. And so some of the Hawaiians there said, well, that's nonsense because we don't have those letters, or that's not a Hawaiian name and things like that. And then I talked to Nahi, who has been doing all the research, and she's saying that their ancient ancestors actually came from Africa, according to their research and their ancient legends, and that the name was an African name. And she said that in the most ancient times those names were used, you know. So it was quite interesting how it tied all together when you look in all these ancient histories. When you get into the most ancient of ancient histories, they all seem to bend together towards Africa or towards some other area where these big stone monoliths are.
Well, that's very true. And what a lot of people don't know is that there are megaliths in Hawaii, which, you know, predate the current, you know, wave of Hawaiians. And I think it's completely nonsense. You know, the conventional archaeology and anthropology states that the, you know, Hawaiians first arrived in around 300 AD. So mm-hmm. that means for at least, you know, 250,000 years of human evolution, that those islands were sitting there with no people on them, you know. And it's always, I think, there's always a racist kind of bend to it, in that if European ancestors didn't know how to sail the seas of the oceans, then nobody else could have. Because, of course, living in Hawaii and building the giant sailing canoe, navigation and traditional navigation was something that we had to study. So that's, you know, I find that again and again as I work with, you know, within native traditions, is that there's always this sometimes subtle, sometimes really blatant racist bend that you get from Western academics in general about, you know, if we didn't do it, or our ancestors didn't do it or couldn't do it, nobody else's ancestors could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you hear that quite often. I've seen that over and over again, where they put down, you know, all kinds of things. And I take it even further. I always say our most ancient ancestors, you know, didn't need boats. You know, they had technologies beyond our wildest, you know, dreams. And that seems to be supported by Karimo's work. And you know, that he's been dating, you know, not just primitive man, but advanced humanity back to something like 600 million years.
Uh-huh.
You know, and we've had to start over as primitives, you know, because of the major cataclysms and pole shifts and comets hitting the earth and you know, and actually some wars. If you go into the ancient Vedic scriptures, it sounds just like the gods had their nuclear wars and had some very, very serious consequences.
Well, exactly. And, you know, that's one thing that a number of different oral traditions speak of in terms of history, is that it happens in a series of waves, you know, and that's the, you know, a pattern that cultures rise and fall. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, and of course the main argument that the academics use against people such as Mr. Karimo, and also people like, well, many other people like David Hatcher Childress and Christopher Dunn, who wrote, you know, the Giza power plant, is when anyone tries to talk of there being technology in the ancient past, they say, well, where is it now? And I, you know, I personally think that the most realistic explanation is the fact that anything that would have been sophisticated and would have been found by a later primitive culture, you know, as the result of some kind of meteor impact, as you say, or whatever, going back to a primitive state, is that anything that was sophisticated would have been recycled, especially if it had material such as gold or crystal or diamonds or anything involved in its workings. Things would have been taken apart and converted into jewelry or all sorts of different things.
Yeah, we can use the pyramid as an example of that. I mean, it once had some beautiful sheathing on it, and all that was ripped off to make other structures. And it's too bad they didn't leave it in its original state. But, you know, it's obvious, yeah, as changes go and people have to resort back to primitive means and back into survival, they are going to utilize whatever's left over. And also, too, they, you know, they've shown... done a lot of studies on places, you know, like it doesn't take very long for a city to turn into rust and dust, basically. And you know, we're talking thousands and thousands of years here, you know, where these events happen. So it, you know, it wouldn't take very long at all for, you know, you watch a jungle take over, you know, a city. A lot of there's a lot of very ancient sites, you know, that are buried in the Amazon and in Africa and other places that you can see from satellite. You can tell there's something there, but it's just completely overgrown and taken over.
Exactly, and there's that great book, I can't remember the name of the author, that came out a few years ago, I believe it's called The World Without Us. Mm-hmm. And that that the book is about if every human being suddenly disappeared, how long it would take for, you know, modern, sophisticated cities to you know, completely collapse, and it's quite alarming when you look at it.
Oh, yeah.
Because New York is used as a classic example, and it's just how quickly, you know, things would get overgrown, how quickly the buildings would fall apart and start to be, you know, recycled back into the earth, which is the normal process anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen buildings that really weren't that old that were pretty solid buildings, and, you know, there's just a few chunks of cement left. You know, it's just a matter of time before the wind and the rain, and, you know, if you have a few earthquakes now and then, you know, it pretty much just levels everything and it's covered by mud, basically, eventually.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, another example is you know, the megaliths in around Cusco are very much debated in terms of who made them. The conventional story is the Inca built everything, but if you read the early chronicles of the Spanish, the Inca said, or what was left of the Inca said to the first Spanish conquistadors, that they didn't build certain of the major megaliths, and that included Tiwanaku. When the first Spanish conquistadors went there, they were astonished at what they saw. And bewildered, they asked the local people, "Did you make this?" And they said, "No, this was there when we arrived."
I know a lot of them also point to the sky. You know, when you say who made this, they point to the sky, and you know, and they said, you know, that the gods made them or whatever. And you know, it seems like you know, in ancient times, especially if you have a primitive people. If somebody did come, you know, out of the sky, if they had some kind of air travel, or even, you know, in the days of American history when they came with the big boats, you know, and the big ships and everything, the Indians were going, whoa, what are these? You know, they didn't know what they were, and you know, there's a lot of tales, you know, about Quetzalcoatl and all the other guys coming in and they mistaking the Spaniards for the ancient gods, and which was their undoing. But you know, all those stories are seem to be, you know, throughout history.
Well, very true, and in the case of the Inca, because you know, it's natural to, you know, with when you're spending time with any culture, to ask about the skies and ask about connections. And with the Inca, it seems to be, you know, and this will be no surprise to anyone, is the Pleiades seem to be a very central little star cluster that was, almost a preoccupation with them. And I've always found, and of course with the Hawaiians as well, there's a great teacher, Hawaiian teacher, who passed on about, I think, 10 years ago. His name was Hale Makua, who lived on Big Island, and I was able to have conversations with him, and he just frankly said, you know, my ancestors came from the Pleiades and also came from Sirius, mm-hmm. without batting an eye.
Yeah, and that's the same story I heard from Nahi over there. She's passed on too as well, but she said the same thing. You know, she said our ancestors come from the Pleiades, and, you know, in the Cherokee Nation, you know, which my great-grandmother was Cherokee, same stories, you know, they come from the Pleiades, they point to the Pleiades, and I know some Lakota elders and some other elders, and they all seem to be pointing, you know, at either Pleiades or some point at the Orion system or Sirian, you know, system, but it seems like everything, when you get into the most ancient of teachings or the most ancient stories, they all go back to the stars.
Well, exactly, and the Pleiades for me is very interesting because there are so many stories from around the world, including in Indonesia. You know, there's another story where, again, it's almost a recurring theme of the seven sisters come down, and six of them return to the sky, but one stays, and the one that stays is the ancestress of a certain people. And the same, of course, with what's it called? Devil's Tower in Wyoming. There's a story there of the same thing where these seven came down, and then a giant bear chased them, and they somehow ascended to the top of Devil's Tower. And the marks on Devil's Tower are supposedly the claw marks of this giant bear trying to get at them. But they again ascended back to heaven, and I believe one of them stayed.
I always wonder if the bear represents, you know, a constellation or something else.
Oh, yeah. That could be. That's very true. Very
true. Maybe there's a little skirmish going on down here, you know, which is still going on. But, you know, I'm curious that, and some of the people there in Peru, I know Peru seems to be like a UFO highway there. And I'm wondering if you've come across anybody that's having contact now or in communication with the ancient ancestors.
Well, the amazing thing is that it's so commonplace here that you know, that people kind of look at me when I ask, you know, it's like, have you seen a UFO? And they, or, you know, they call them OVNI in Spanish. And they, you know, most people just say, yeah, why? What's, you know, what's so special about it? including, I was just, I guess 2 days ago, I was on the series Ancient Aliens, episode 4 of season 3, and there's a little lake called Paray outside of Cusco where supposedly these disc-shaped craft, which are about 20 feet in diameter, enter and leave this lake. And we did find local farmers who said, yeah. To Westerners, we're always like in awe and shock. And another little story I have is there was one of my first trips to Peru, I think it was 4 years ago. There was a major earthquake in Peru, which shook Lima, where I was staying at the time. And so the family I was staying with all ran outside into the street, and I was staring at the ground because I could literally see the ground rippling. But afterwards, my fiance, who's now my wife, her sisters and she were looking up at the sky, and her sister, who is a lawyer, so she's very logical and level-headed, you know, simply said, you know, that they had seen a mile across mothership flying across above Lima and descending into the ocean. And at least 50% of all cell phone service and electrical service was interrupted in Lima for about 4 hours. And there was no logical explanation as to why. It wasn't the earthquake itself. The light simply went off and then came back on as if there had been a major electromagnetic occurrence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there does seem to be a lot of stories coming out of there. And you know, the same thing happened to me. I went down to Mexico, and I was going to do a talk. And I kind of combined the ancient history, the UFOs, and even tied into a lot of religions and things like that. And so I have this presentation that I was showing all these terrible photographs and footage and everything. And, you know, I noticed whenever I was talking about the UFOs, they just looked at me and go, "So what?" You know, like, and they didn't care about it, really. They just go, "Yeah, that's nice." But they were really interested in the paranormal stuff.
And, oh, you know, really?
Yeah, yeah. But I thought that was amazing that, you know, you go down there and it's just an accepted reality. They said, "Yeah, so, you know, same thing. So what? You know, what's the big deal?" And then here you try to tell somebody and they look at you sideways like you're crazy, you know, and they have swirling their finger around their ear going, "This guy's lost it." And, you know, the old giggle factor is highly, highly involved in that one. But I think that's been perfpetrated over the years because the government does know the UFOs exist and been back engineering for a long time. So they're heavily involved in, you know, making people look stupid or ridiculous. But it is amazing. You go anywhere else, just almost everywhere around the world, and it's just a common thing. They just go, "Yeah, so what?" You know.
Yeah, well, actually, one of the best YouTube videos, and I can't remember what it's called, but that seemed completely realistic in terms of there being a disc-shaped craft, actually was taken in Peru, you know, with a very amateur kind of camera, you know, video camera. But the great thing was that there's this disc floating above this village, and in the foreground, there's this old native woman. I think she was literally digging for potatoes. And she looks up over her shoulder, looks at it, and then turns back down and continues digging the potatoes. As you know, as if it's like, "Oh, there's another one."
Yeah. I know, it is hilarious. It's just amazing the difference in cultures. And you know, when I talked to them down in Mexico, they consider it a very spiritual thing. And they've tied it into their spirituality and they love Our Lady of Guadalupe, and you know, it's really funny, even though they've really tried to push, you know, Jesus as the main dude down there, they won't have it. You know, they have their gatherings, and it's always Our Lady of Guadalupe up front, you know, in the procession, and then Jesus comes after that, you know. So I think it's interesting how they have retained a lot of their culture, and although the other culture has been imposed on them, you know, some of the other religious cultures, they've still retained, you know, some of their old belief systems and experiences.
Well, that's a very good point, because that's very common in Peru. A lot of the folklore, dancing, and things of that nature that still exist to this day have, like you say, they have this, you know, all, this surface of being Catholic, but underneath it is all of the symbolism that dates back to the Inca and earlier cultures. So it's as though, in some instances, what they're doing is they're trying to pacify the Catholic influence by exhibiting it, or, you know, the same with showing the cross or showing Jesus, but there's always the underlying theme, and that's included with the almost preoccupation in Latin America with the Virgin Mary being almost more important than being Jesus himself. And I think the logic behind that is that one of the great deities of many cultures in the Americas is the earth itself. In Quechua, it's called Pachamama. So I think Mother Mary simply replaced as a symbol Pachamama, but Pachamama is still, you know, worshipped.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I like, too, a lot of the ancient, you know, the Mayan teachings and things, you know, they talk about the, you know, the black hole at the center of the galaxy, you know, is basically the womb of the mother, you know, which gives birth to all life. And a lot of Native Americans have that teaching, too. And, you know, it ties into everything as birth from the same mother, that everything is family and everything is connected. And I think that's a lot better belief system than the one we have now, where everything is disconnected, you know, and a lot of chosen ones running around that think they're special.
Well, that's a great point, and actually that's the main reason why, as a child, I got involved in Native, that's where all the carving and everything came from for me, is that it was learning the oral traditions, the storytelling of the Native people, including the Haida of the west coast of Canada, is the fact that in their stories, every life form was on the same level. So all the animals, the plants, and people were on the same level. And in my earliest childhood, of course, you know, I learned all the English stories of, you know, Peter Rabbit and Winnie the Pooh and things, where animals are, you know, are used in a sort of mocking manner, and that humans are, and of course the Bible is full of that, you know, dominion over the earth kind of thing. And that's what drew my attention was the fact that here were people who had a belief system where humans weren't special, you know, weren't necessarily special. They were part of creation. And I think in terms of, you know, the future of our planet depends on us returning to that. Otherwise, we're very, very, you know, we're going to be in very deep trouble.
Yeah, I have a feeling that nature is going to return us to that.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like I always say, you know, there's that old saying, you know, man plans and God laughs. And I always say man plans and nature laughs. And although we may have our go at it, you know, nature always has the last word. And if we get out of alignment with nature, then we just may be removed and have to get back in touch with her.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. There's a great YouTube video or video with George Carlin on it, where, you know, he's making fun of people who want to save the earth. You know, we have to save the planet. It's like, the planet's fine. We're the ones who are screwed.
Yeah. You know, I love that bumper sticker says save the humans, you know, instead of save the whales. The other one says save the humans, and it's a little more accurate.
That's very true.
Yeah. You know, I'm fascinated by this outrigger that you were working on, the 62-foot double hull outrigger. Now, one of those could sail almost anywhere, especially with a big sail on it. I mean, it would take no time at all to be bouncing around between islands and I don't know, you could probably, if you pick the right weather or the right time, you could actually bounce around between continents on one of those.
Oh, exactly. That's, you know, that was the one of the major fascinations of mine with, you know, assisting in building, because we were using all of the proportions that were Hawaiian were what we used. Mm-hmm. So the proportions are very, very different from what a catamaran is. A Hawaiian canoe is a double hull is approximately the width is 1/4 the length, whereas in most catamarans now it's like the width is half. So, and they're all these different, it's all based on sacred geometry. Mm-hmm. So the canoe itself and all of the proportions are based on the shapes of the waves and all natural forces, so that it was a naturally efficient way to travel, because it obeyed not only the laws of physics but the laws of nature.
Mm-hmm. You know, I saw a video once a long time ago, and it was a guy carved the ark, you know, in the exact proportions, you know, as the Bible or whatever. And he had this ark, he would spin this ark, and it would spin around, and then it would spin back to its original position almost. And it was so stable that it always righted itself, and it would spin, you know, it would always go back to where it was, you know, if you spun it or pushed it or whatever. And I just thought that was amazing how back in the day that they actually carved or created boats that, you know, with some kind of sacred geometry that really kept them stable and somehow, you know, they would actually kind of almost break the laws of physics in a way.
Well, actually, that's interesting, because I can't remember them. Was it Hochstetter is his name? Because I actually met during the building of the Hawaiian canoe, he came and gave us a lecture, and he brought the model. And he did that.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is that he also equated the hull design of the Egyptians with that of the Hawaiians as well. And you know, there's a lot of talk that the design of the Egyptian ships were not meant for going up and down the Nile. They were, you know, they were transoceanic ships. Mm-hmm. Based on the proportions and things like that. So that, you know, that's a very interesting link. I haven't thought of that guy for years, but all of a sudden he comes back up, because he did do that. He spun the model, and it went clockwise, and then it stopped, and it went backwards. And it's like, whoa.
Yeah, I saw that, and I go, wow, that is interesting, you know, and how, you know, using that the ancient knowledge and the sacred geometry would actually create a vessel that was self-righting, and it would actually stay on course. It's amazing, you know, how we have forgotten, you know, that ancient knowledge.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
You know, we build things to just plow through the waves and you know, the designs and everything else are just definitely not created under the same guidelines.
But that's a good point. And actually, the same thing is with a kayak. I have a traditional Greenland Inuit kayak, and I've never been interested in kayaks until I got this one. But the whole thing is based on the traditional proportions, and so it's amazingly efficient at the way it travels, and it's all ergonomics. And so modern kayaks, you know, they're using wind tunnels and all sorts of things to try to make them more efficient. And none of these designers even look at the old designs. And, you know, I it's sort of comical, A, or stupid, B, that there's so much of that happens in the modern world where people don't look at native traditions for their thousands upon thousands of years of practical wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen that again and again. The canoes, I was over in, I'm not sure where it was. It was over near Kona, and I was speaking at a conference there, and they had a museum there that gave the history, and they had some of these ancient kayaks there, or the canoes. And I was looking at these canoes, and I was just looking at the canoe, and I had this big flash forward or something, that there was really important for some reason that I was paying attention to that and looking at it. And I walked all around it and looked how it was carved, and it really had an impact. And I still don't know why, you know, maybe it's because of the show. I don't know that I was supposed to pay attention to it, but I'll never forget that. You know, there was a real strong energy that came in while I was looking at that canoe.
Oh, that's, yeah. Well, it's, you know, it's the most important, or was the most important symbol to, you know, the Polynesian people, whether it be Tahitians or, you know, Hawaiians or people from Easter Island or whever, because that's, you know, that was the that's what brought them from one, you know, one world to another world. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where that's how the ancestors traveled. That's how the major deities traveled. So that was the, yeah, you know, that the voyaging canoe was, you know, was the focal point of the whole belief system.
I know, hanging out with the kahunas over there, I'm wondering if you had a chance to run into either the night walkers or the, what is it, the mo'o, the big lizard being.
Well, actually, that's a great question. The thing is, the canoe itself that we built, you know, called Mo'o Kiha. Mo'o is lizard,
yeah,
and uh-huh. Kiha is sacred. And before that, I was actually on Kauai on the north shore near Hana Lei, and there are two caves there. There's the wet cave and the dry cave, which are both related to the voyage and movement of Pele, the, you know, goddess of the volcanoes. So there's the wet cave is actually, it's like a lagoon that goes into this cave. And so one day I took a windsurf board and went in there and started paddling around because I didn't know how far, you know, my curiosity, I didn't know how far it would go. But all the time that I was on that surf, you know, windsurf board moving around, I felt that there was a presence there, and it wasn't evil, but it also wasn't benevolent. It was like, you know, almost like this thing of, what are you doing here? And it wasn't until after I left and was reading a book on, you know, Hawaiian tales, that cave itself is the domain of one of the mo'os.
Yeah.
So it's as though, you know, the energy was still there and saying, I don't think you asked permission.
Uh-huh.
I won't kill you, but I think I'm going to, you know, teach you a lesson. Go back and read a book.
Yeah, I've had some experiences like that over there, and I actually stayed in a house that was right on the trail of the night walkers, and boy, I had an interesting evening that night. You know, it was, you know, we had an experience, you know, but mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm still here, thank God.
Oh, sorry, but Hawaii, you know, Hawaii, for anyone who has any level of sensitivity, is an amazing place because it's just, you know, even though the culture has gone through such an awful, you know, decline as the result of the impact of, you know, the Western world, sure, there still is, all of that energy is still there. And of course, you know, the common term that's used is chicken skin, where you suddenly get this ripple, you know, of energy, and it can happen in the most unlikely places. But if you ask someone who is cognizant of Hawaiian tradition, they'll say, well, yeah, you're standing on someone's grave, or this is where this happened, or that, and you're going, oh, wow.
Yeah, we had an experience there. It was pretty funny. I almost, you know, it's kind of weird talking about it, but you know, I was sleeping one night in this place, and there was a legend that the mo'o was around that area, and so one night I heard this thing walking out there, and it was like on gravel, and it sounded like it was dragging a big tail, and it went by the window, and all of a sudden it lifted its head up, and I could see this silhouette, and I go, what the heck is that, you know? And then it went back down again and took off, and it went walking off. And I couldn't see it, and I talked to this guy there who's a very spiritual guy, and he said, oh, you know, that's the mo'o. It comes around here now and then. And so I wanted to get a picture of it, and I did get a picture of it raising its head up in the window. I grabbed my camera and took a picture of it. And then, all you could see is an outline, you know, a dark outline. So anyway, I was putting food out for it and trying to catch it, you know, and I heard it again, and I was running out with my camera trying to catch it, you know. And when I took pictures out the window, all I saw was all this red orbs, a whole lot of red orbs in the area where that sound was coming from. You know, never caught it. And then finally, the third time, I went running outside because there was a security light that popped on. And I went running outside and I put food out for it. And I saw this strangest thing. It looked like a dog. And it was taking off across, you know, down the road. But its legs weren't moving, and its tail was bent, and there was something wrong with this dog. It just wasn't right. And I talked to Nahi about it, and she goes, you know, they can shapeshift, and what they'll do is they'll shapeshift into a dog or something familiar, you know, so you don't know who they are or what they are. And she said, but they never get it right. They never quite get the animal right when they try to do it. And all I can say is what I saw was not... It was kind of a dog. It was a big white dog, but its tail was broken, went up and was broken and came back down, and its legs weren't moving when it ran away. You know, so So it was just some kind of a, almost like a little hologram or something. I don't know what it was, but it was pretty bizarre. You know, all I can say is what I saw. I can't really come to any real conclusions about it.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, a lot of those legends are there. It's a special place, and there's a lot of, you know, crazy stuff. And I know if you're curious about it and open to it and search it out, you'll have some bizarre experiences that you can't explain.
Well, exactly. I found that to be true in any culture, is that if you're respectful and you want to learn, and even if you come from a distant place, you will find, especially amongst, you know, what's left of the elders, you know, you'll find one or two who will, you know, I had that fortunate experience in that I was adopted in Hawaii by an auntie, and the stuff she told me was like, what?
but yeah.
It was, you know, real, you know, she told me real, you know, connections with, you know, with Moo and all sorts of things with a very straight face. She's, you know, and it's only because I spent time with her and, you know, I just did things for her. And, you know, gradually the stories start to come out. If you go to these people and you say, I'm writing a book and, you know, I want to record you, it's like, forget it. You know, it's like with any shamanic person, they're not going to tell you unless they know, you know, what your integrity is and why you're there. But if you're, you know, the reasoning behind why you're there is out of curiosity, and if you want to be of assistance to the people and the culture, then it's like, you know, you may become adopted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found out that, you know, a few gifts and, you know, a pure heart and open mind really help in these situations. And a lot of people come with the wrong intent and they just get pushed aside and they won't sit down and talk story with you. You know, they'll just smile and let you run your program and tell you to have a nice day and walk away with nothing.
Yeah, but and then there are others who will also make up stories.
I've heard that.
And the only problem with that, though, is that then people will write these stories down and say, you know, the Hawaiians said this, and it's like, oh, they didn't say that, you know. But that's...
That happens.
Well, it's one way that a lot of different cultures, and especially, you know, shamanic people and spiritual people who are the carriers of the traditions, they protect the tradition that way. It's like, tell them something, you know. Tell them black is white, you know. Great. Goodbye.
Exactly. Yeah, I was doing some ceremony with Nahi, and we did this meditation, and she was doing this singing, you know, to invoke the ancestors, and very, very powerful. And all of a sudden, I looked up, and I saw these beings, and, I mean, their heads alone were just massive. I mean, they were giants. I mean, they were huge, and she just started smiling at me, you know, and she said, those are the ancients, and I was telling her what I saw, and it just blew me away, and just the size of these beings. And you know, I'm wondering if you've come across any stories or historical artifacts or anything that show some of these ancient ancestors to be extremely large human beings.
Well, I'm still actually trying to track that down. You know, in the beginning of our conversation, you were asking about the bodies aside from the elongated skulls, and that's what I'm really on the quest for now, because the conventional story is that they were, you know, like supposedly 1.65 to 1.7 meters tall, which isn't very big. But I did meet a couple of weeks ago. I met a Huacero, which is a grave robber, who you know, unfortunately, sometimes you have to deal with people like this. In my case, in order to make sure that some of the artifacts that he finds don't leave the country, because some of the best stuff winds up going to Europe and the U.S. But he was in possession of a skull, and so I was elongated skull, and so I was able to ask him about the size of the body, and he said at least 2.3 to 2.4 meters was the total height of these people. And modern day Peruvians are quite in general diminutive people. So, and it's also said about the Inca that the Inca were actually physically quite tall and very, you know, did not look as Indian like as a lot of the paintings of them are shown to be. They're actually supposedly had red hair, not black hair, and light colored skin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. The you know, I've seen over and over again some of the work that's coming out about the giants. And, you know, they're finding these giant skeletons, you know, all over the place, but it gets suppressed. You know, it goes into Smithsonian grabs that are, or it goes into some museum and it gets thrown into the basement, and they're told not to be bringing these things out because it upsets the status quo.
Well, true, and I have a number of Maori friends from New Zealand, and they some of them have told me that you know, large skeletons have been found. You know, giant being a relative term, but say, you know, 7.5 to 8 feet tall people have been found, but those skeletons have immediately been confiscated by the government. And then they wind up disappearing somewhere, or some of them have even been in other parts of, or in parts of North America. I've heard stories where governmental or museum officials or whoever have taken these skeletons and in some cases destroyed them in order reburied them without telling anyone where they are, so that the evidence is not shown to the general public.
Yeah, I've heard there's a lot of stuff underneath the Vatican in those catacombs, and it's all cataloged, and including, you know, the tablets that were over there at the Easter Island, that were at the base of those monuments. You know, they took all the tablets from there, as well as, and they talked about the people who they were and you know, who each person was. It was a monument to a being, but quite interesting, you know, because it was in total conflict with, you know, the teachings of the church or whatever. So they either destroyed them, threw them into the ocean, or they took them back, you know, and have stored a lot of these ancient artifacts there. So I think one of these days, if we really dig into the basements of the Vatican and the Smithsonian and bring all that information out, we're going to have a real reality check about our ancient past.
Well, that's a great point, and I have met a member of the Easter Island or Rapa Nui royal family, and she let me stay with her on Oahu for a couple of days, and she let me ask, you know, any question I wanted to, but when it came to what you're talking about, which are the Rongo Rongo hieroglyphs or you know, writing system, she just refused to talk, and I just went, oh, okay, and... Basically, I said, it's too bad that no one is able to read them anymore. And she said, why would you think that? Mm-hmm. Meaning that there are all these, you know, experts who are trying to unravel the mystery. And she said, we know what is written on them, but we're not going to tell you because why should we, you know, what are you going to do with the information? You know, again, we go back to cultural sensitivity. What are you going to do with the information? Is this a benefit to my people? Yeah. Or do you want to, or do you want to write a book and make $1 million? You know, what's the story?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I'm running that again and again. You know, unfortunately we're running out of time. It's just been awesome talking with you, and I'm sure we could talk for another 2 hours, but we have a 1 hour show. But, you know, what's the best website to get a hold of your information and contact you or any of the books or other information that you have?
My prime website is hiddenincatours.com.
Okay.
And on that I have more than 500 YouTube videos that I've taken, photos, and some of the upcoming tours. I do give tours of Cusco in the Sacred Valley. One of them coming up is in November with a group from England called Megalithomania. So we're doing a major 14-day tour of all of the major megalithic sites in Peru and Bolivia, and that's on the homepage of my website.
Great. Hey, well, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. It's been awesome talking to you, and we'll have to do it again real soon.
Oh, an absolute honor, James. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care.
You too.
Well, folks, unfortunately, we're out of time. This is James Gillen with As You Wish Talk Radio signing off. And again, watch the skies. Check out that Carmichael, California UFO sighting. Just a massive fleet of ships were flying over California. And it looks just like the Guadalajara sightings and the Mexico sightings. So they're here, you know, pay attention to the sky and, you know, send them lots of love and blessings. And you might want to tell them we might need a little help getting through these times. But anyway, this is James Gillen signing off. Have a great evening.